whoever you are, wherever you are, and whenever it is, you are catching some rain waves coming to you from the banks of the gelid and frosty St. Vrain River in almost always sunny Longmont, Colorado. I'm Becky Peters, and across the table is the co-host who can divide by zero. He's Ben Cobb. Ben, what's good?
It's all good, Becky. I can honestly say that I'm having the time of my life.
Having the time of his life!
Doing this show. I know you and I have both just been blown away by the number of teachers across the country who've latched onto and learned from the giants in education who we've had the privilege of interviewing. And I've benefited so much from preparing and reading the books of each of our guests that even if my mom was our only one listening to this show, it really has been the best learning experience of my entire life. When we started Vrain Waves back in March, the only thing I knew about the brain came from Adam Sandler movies.
A medulla oblongata.
That is correct.
And then we interviewed Glenn Whitman, and in episode 8, he recommended a new podcast. And I went on and downloaded every single episode and listened to it all. It's a podcast called The Learning Scientists, and we are super lucky to have them on the show today.
Absolutely, Ben. Dr. Megan Samaraki and Dr. Yana Weinstein together are called the Learning Scientists, and they've co-authored a really binge-worthy book entitled Understanding How We Learn, which is a visual guide to many of the strategies that we'll discuss with them today.
And before we get into our interview, we're going to jump into our Wayback Time Machine to get a glimpse into the very unconventional origin story of this dynamic duo. This is Dr. Yana Weinstein.
Does it sound okay?
And she was a super successful psychologist who earned her PhD from the University College in London. And one day she found herself thinking,
I'm not really doing that. I'm supposedly doing research in applying cognitive psychology to education, but I don't think I know of anybody who has applied a single thing I've done. All I've done is publish in applied journals, but that's about as applied as it got. And so then I thought maybe I should be doing something. Maybe I should be helping students somewhere around, you know, anywhere to study using these techniques that I know are effective.
She didn't want to just publish into a void. She wanted her research to make a difference in the lives of real people. So she went to the last place that you would ever expect to encounter a bottled water drinking, elbow patch cardigan sweater wearing cognitive psychologist. She went to Twitter.
My ridiculous idea was to search on Twitter to see if any students out there were tweeting requesting help for how to study. And so I started responding to these strangers with little pithy, you know, at the time it was 140 characters. So I would respond to them with, well, have you tried taking a blank piece of paper and writing out everything you know from memory? And, you know, most of the time these students would ignore me. Some of the times they would say, who are you? Get off my timeline. And then occasionally they would respond and say, oh, no, I've never tried that. Maybe I will.
Now, I know what you're thinking, that posting study advice to random teenagers' timeline is the fastest way to get blocked other than posting Rickroll memes. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down. But you're wrong, because across the country, another cognitive psychologist, Dr. Megan Samaraki, was up late, trying to fall asleep, tossing, turning, and tweeting.
I was actually laying in bed and, you know, supposed to be going to sleep and doing that horrible thing where I'm playing on my phone, you know, social media thing. And I saw Yana tweeting at students. And I was like, what are you doing? And what, you know, who are these people? What, you know, why are you talking to random children? And she kind of, you know, told me what she was doing. And the two of us, I was like, oh, I'll join.
And join she did. And this fearsome duo went from random tweets to topping the Apple podcast charts, from publishing to a void to publishing a binge-worthy book about learning, all while speaking at dozens of conferences and consulting districts all over the country. All this made possible because of the power of social media. So we couldn't be more excited today to talk to the learning scientists.
So in this episode, we talk about how to use learning strategies like retrieval practice, spacing, and interleaving in order to maximize long-term retention of skills and concepts. The interview that you're about to hear is a great introduction to the work they do, but if you're hungry for more, please check out their podcast where they venture deeper into the research and application of these strategies and more. So without further ado, let's get into the interview.
My first question about your six strategies is, I mean, you have podcasts
podcasts that go deeper on each one of those. So I highly encourage our listeners to check those out. They're fascinating. But my first question is, how did you decide which ones made the list?
Yes, so that actually wasn't us. So I guess it would have been around 2007. Hal Pashler and a number of other cognitive psychologists were commissioned by IES, the Institute for Education Sciences, to create a report. And their task, if we boil it down a little bit, was to essentially go through and identify the strategies, learning strategies that are in the literature that have been tested, and identify which ones have a lot of evidence to support their effectiveness, which ones maybe have a lot of, you know, evidence to support their ineffectiveness, and which ones we don't really have a whole lot of evidence for. And so the six strategies are the ones that were identified in that report as having the most evidence to support their effectiveness. Spaced practice and retrieval practice, from our view, probably have the most evidence, but all six of these have a pretty strong evidence base to support effectiveness in some way, shape, or form.
And I think that, you know, to some extent we did shape them, because there have been various iterations. So there was that report in 2007, then there was another more recent report, or there's actually a report of how much these strategies are being taught to trainee teachers. And in each case, the strategies and how exactly they've been portrayed has changed a little bit over time because of recent research. And I think we also took a look at what we knew about the recent research and shaped the strategies to reflect that as best we could.
Yeah, so personally, I've done research on retrieval practice. I've done some stuff on spacing, never anything specifically looking at spacing effects, but you know, spacing is always part of the formula. I've done dual coding type research, specifically looking at whether or not matching to learning style and retrieval practice matters. The bottom line is that it doesn't. Of course, we know that learning styles doesn't really help, but the point really was, okay, well, if a student has a preference for visual, can they draw to practice retrieval, or does it have to be verbal? Of course, it doesn't matter. If you like to draw, go ahead and draw, as long as you're bringing the information to mind. So that touches on dual coding. My dissertation was on elaboration. Yana's done a lot of work on interleaving in addition to spacing and retrieval practice. So we cover the full range. We just have more expertise in some areas than other areas.
Yeah, I would love to drill down on one of those. Which one would y'all feel most excited about chatting about?
I mean, I always love talking about retrieval practice, but we can talk about any of the strategies that you like.
Is that okay with you, Yana?
Retrieval practice? For sure. Yeah.
Cool. Definitely. Awesome. Well, let's dig in a little bit to retrieval practice. Can you put it in layman's terms for us, what that means? And then maybe talk to us about an ideal classroom that did that really well, how a teacher would use the science to help their teaching be more effective.
Yeah. So retrieval practice is basically just bringing information to mind. So this actually used to be called the testing effect. We called it the testing effect for quite some time and referred to it as testing. And I like that in some ways because it sort of, it's attempting to get away from the negativity associated with the word testing. But really, it's not the test per se. It's the processing that occurs or tends to occur while you're taking a test. And that is the thinking about something and bringing it to mind, basically putting your course materials away and trying to pull that up and reconstruct it from your memory. So that tends to happen during a test. Although, of course, if you sit and you can't answer any questions on a test, not a lot of retrieval is happening. But it doesn't have to be a test. So you could just sit down with a blank sheet of paper and try to write out as much as you can remember. I mentioned some research that I've done that's currently unpublished, but about drawing what you know. And that study showed that it worked. And in theory, that should be a good way to practice retrieval. There's some research out there showing that if you try to create concept maps from memory, which is just sort of taking a bunch of different ideas, putting them down in like little nodes, or, you know, draw a little circle around them, little boxes, and then connect the different ideas and write down how they're related. If you do that from memory, that's going to be better than just sort of, you know, going from your textbook over to your page and sort of copying it down. Even if you're reorganizing when you're making the concept map, putting the material away and reconstructing it, the research shows, is better for long-term understanding and flexibility. So it's really just about bringing that information to mind. So this could happen in classrooms in a lot of different ways. And I don't I don't know if we can say what the exact perfect way would be for any specific classroom, because there's so many different ways of doing it. And there are a lot of different contexts and factors to play with.
Yeah. And that's actually exactly what I was going to jump in and say, but you already said it for me. So that's perfect. Which was, as soon as I hear, ideally, it's like, well, you know, it's just going to depend. And I know that that's not a very satisfying answer, but that is the reality. We can't get out there and say, if you do it this way, it's going to work, or, you know, make sure you're definitely going to do this. So, you know, it's really hard to say ideally, because it's going to depend on, you know, what level the students are at and what the long-term goals are. Like, are you preparing them for a specific exam? Are you hoping they'll retain that knowledge to the following semester, which is really like when we teach our students, we're really hoping that they won't just pass the exam, but that they'll actually retain that knowledge and be able to utilize it either in a future semester or even better, just in real life. Because when we think of acquiring skills or knowledge, we really hope that what we're teaching our students is useful and that they might be able to draw upon it, you know, either in a job or even like in a job interview or in situations where they need it dynamically. And that's a very different kind of goal to preparing for a specific exam. And so, you know, depending on the end point, like the goal and the starting point of where the students are, that's already two big factors, and those are just two of any number of factors.
Yeah, so a good anecdote from my research that I think illustrates this, and the fact that, you know, we've kind of been learning it along the way too, is that one of the easiest ways with most college students to have them practice retrieval is to just give them a blank sheet of paper or, you know, a blank document on the computer and just have them type or write what they can remember. And they'll, you know, put it into their own words. They won't get everything, but essentially they're kind of organizing, creating their own retrieval structure in their minds and going from there. And if they're able to recall 50, 60, 70% of the key information, that's going to help them compared to just rereading or continuing to study. And if they repeatedly do this, if then they say, okay, I've written out what I can remember, I've identified holes, I'm going to go back and check my notes, look at those things that I wasn't quite sure about, identify things where I, you know, made mistakes or I wasn't quite on point, and then I'm going to put my stuff away and try to retrieve again. Doing that over time is really effective. Well, that's not going to work even for every college student. And we learned this kind of the hard way. When I was a graduate student in Jeff Karpicki's lab at Purdue, we were going into fourth grade classrooms in Indianapolis and trying to look at ways to implement retrieval practice in the fourth grade classroom. And we identified fourth grade because that's around about the time where they're making that transition from learning to read to reading to learn. And so we thought this would be a good time to have them, you know, try to read and then write out the information on a blank sheet of paper. And we sort of naively truly thought at the time, as long as the material was at their level, so we were using fourth grade textbooks, this should be no problem. Well, that's not really how it went. And so, you know, we gave these fourth graders these little paragraphs out of their textbooks, read it to them, had them follow along, and then gave them the blank sheet of paper. And they recalled very, very little of the information. I want to say it was 8 or 9% of the information. It ends up being basically like 1 to 2 ideas or so out of the text. And usually the text would start out basically saying like, we're going to learn about the desert or clouds or whatever. And so if the kid wrote down clouds and that was it, they still got one idea. Right? So really, retrieval was really low. And so not surprisingly, it didn't result in great learning, not in the short term, not in the long term. And so we really had to go back to the drawing board and think, okay, how are we going to increase retrieval success? We don't want it to be too easy, because of course, you could just have kids copy back and forth. That's not retrieval. You're going to get every word right, but that's not retrieval. But we don't want it to be so hard that they can't engage in the processing at all. And so we ended up kind of scaffolding and having the kids, we gave them partial concept maps where they just had to put in the linking ideas or the main ideas into the map, let them do it with their little paragraph first, then gave them a new one and said, now try to do this from memory. They were much more successful, and then they were able to answer more questions later on compared to that reading. And so giving them some structure and some scaffolding really helped. And I don't think this is just fourth graders compared to adults. It's really going to be anyone who's doing something that is very difficult for them, something where they don't have a lot of background knowledge or they're struggling a bit. It might then be very difficult for them to retrieve the information and they're going to need some more structure.
Absolutely. So retrieval makes a ton of sense for me when I think of, you know, learning about the Civil War or a bicameral legislative branch where it's content, memory, knowledge. But how does retrieval work when you're trying to learn a skill, like a communication skill or something like that? Is there any studies or science on that?
I mean, I don't know about specific studies on communication skills, but I mean, to me, I think what I like to think about is that you can deconstruct any kind of skill or task you're trying to learn into, I guess, retrievable pieces, and they don't have to be verbatim retrievable, right? So that's a common misconception, which is that with retrieval practice, we're just kind of memorizing, verbatim exactly the same thing and then reproducing it. It can be applying the knowledge that we've gained to different situations. So if you're trying to learn a skill, you might have students retrieve how to apply a particular set of actions or, you know, a procedure to different situations, and that would be retrieval practice, as opposed to, say, having in front of you what the procedure is and then trying to apply it, which is doing it without retrieval practice. What would you say, Megan? Is that right?
Yeah. So when my husband and I were practicing our first dance for the wedding, we had it all like written out, and we would practice each individual little skill after looking at it. But eventually you have to just sort of turn on the music and try to go through it. It's really just practicing. You don't think of it as retrieval practice, but for procedural skills like that, that kind of is retrieval practice. It almost makes more sense, and it's really intuitive.
Yeah.
Right.
It's sort of practice.
And it's probably been studied, in thousands and thousands of research studies, just not under the term retrieval practice. It's more like if you look under, you know, sports psychology and so on and so forth, they talk about practice all the time. And even interleaving appears there a lot, but it's not necessarily called interleaving. So there's a lot of these, the same concepts being studied, but maybe with different terminology and perhaps from less of a cognitive perspective and more of a kind of behavioral, like if you study like this, what kind of outcome are you going to have, but not necessarily delve into what are the processes in the mind that facilitate that outcome. So that's kind of where we come from as cognitive psychologists to add that piece.
Awesome. Yeah, and I'd say too that it's not even just for areas where you're, quote, memorizing things. It doesn't have to just be about memorizing facts. Of course, you need to know the facts in order to apply them. So to some extent, there are certain things that you just need to know, or at least know enough so that you can then search for the rest of the information that you need. If you can't remember anything, the internet isn't going to help you. The books are not going to help you if you don't know where to look or what to do. But then even when we talk about remembering these facts, retrieval practice doesn't just help you regurgitate them. It actually makes you better able to flexibly apply them in the future. So one example from one of my experiments is we were teaching the students about the water cycle. And you can ask them basic questions, you know, the definition of precipitation. You can ask them, you know, what is an aquifer, those types of things. But then on the assessment test, we would also ask them questions that ask them to apply what they learned in new situations. So imagine the water cycle exists in a place with no gravity. What then will happen to the aquifers? Well, they never read about that, of course, because there's always gravity. But essentially, it talks about gravity pulling the water into these aquifers. And so if there's no gravity, you can figure out what's going to be happening with that cycle. So it makes you more flexible.
But you talked about both retrieval practice and spacing and how that's been linked to increasing creativity. Is that what you mean by that? Like being able to apply it in novel and dynamic situations, like transferring that learning into other places?
I think that actually there are some places where it is referred to literally as creativity. And actually, incidentally, we just had a digest come out about creativity and how to, what the science of creativity says. And it's often almost counterintuitive because everybody thinks of creativity as this kind of intangible thing that's just like, oh, I'm creative. Well, I'm not creative, but actually it's a skill that can be developed very purposely by doing things that are ultimately cognitive. So it's interesting to look at it from that perspective.
I love your weekly digest. I'm just going to put a plug in for those for our listeners. They grab a topic or a theme and then give you all these different research resources around it. They're really, really good. So thank you guys for vetting those and sending them out. They're amazing. When you were talking about retrieval practice, and another one of the six strategies then is spacing, and you guys, you know, have a few resources about that as well. And I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about how spacing plays into retrieval and when we should be trying to retrieve the information, the content that we're trying to grab.
Right, absolutely. And it's funny because often when I give my talks, it usually starts the other way and we do the spacing part and then we get to, well, what are people actually going to do when they space? Whereas it probably even makes more sense to say, okay, here's how you study, which is through retrieval practice. And now, like you asked, when might you schedule those study episodes? So that's a really great way to ask the question. So what the literature generally shows is that, let's say you have an end goal in mind and it's an exam in a month. If you have, let's say, 10 hours total that you're going to be studying at some point during that month, if you can space out your studying and review the topics that you're studying multiple times leading up to that exam, rather than reviewing them kind of quickly over and over again right before the exam, you're going to have better long-term retention of that information. So you will not only potentially do better in that exam, but then also not immediately forget the information after you leave the exam. And as I mentioned before, we're really concerned with having students be able to carry that knowledge forward and not just, you know, dump it out on the exam and leave. So for example, if you think about medical exams, it's kind of important. The whole point of those tests is to see whether the training doctors actually know about these conditions, not whether they can memorize them for the test, because that's obviously totally pointless. So with spacing, you know, it's a lot harder to do, because then you have to be kind of thinking in advance and thinking ahead. It's not something you can do right at the last minute. And it's also tricky because cramming, which is the opposite of spacing, can work just for that exam that's coming the next day, because if you just review information, it will be kind of fresh in your mind for a very short amount of time and then quickly dissipate. But what we want is the long-term learning. And so what we want to encourage students to do is to be able to schedule study sessions so that they encounter material in a class and then a little bit goes by, they maybe forget a little bit of it, and then they retrieve it ideally a bit later. So they're making an effort to retrieve that information. They've like started to forget it. And that retrieval effort after a short delay, or a delay that lets them forget a little bit, is what's going to boost the memory in the long run. And then you can play with the exact delay. And we often get questions about the ideal spacing schedule. And that's kind of like what you asked before about how does, you know, retrieval practice work in classroom ideally, how does spacing work in classroom ideally, and we can't, you know, it's impossible, no one can answer those questions. All we know is that you're going to want to leave gaps that are somewhat realistic given the end goal, right? So if the end goal is in a year, you're not going to be able to retrieve all of the information for that exam every single week, because then you just constantly be retrieving information. You're much more likely to spread it out and maybe retrieve it once a month or something so that you can add on all the additional information. If your exam is in a month, you're more likely to be retrieving it more frequently. So, you know, it's kind of almost common sense at that point. And there are different ways to do this. You know, we can either try to put the onus on students and say, okay, you have all this practice material, now go and schedule your study time and try to do some retrieval practice every day or whatever. Or as instructors, we can kind of not hide the spaced retrieval practice, but, you know, kind of introduce it in a way that students kind of there anyway. It's part of their daily task, but now we're asking them to retrieve information from, say, a week ago and also a month ago, so that it's constantly being refreshed. And so that's it's less of a burden on the students, because it's just something that they're doing in class as opposed to something they have to like put forward the effort and motivation to remember to do.
Yeah. And one of the analogies that we came up with very early on that I really like involves sort of whether or not you're hiding some of these things or just having the students do it. So, you know, tests or quizzes are not things that students typically enjoy. In fact, some students have test anxiety. Some students might get, you know, worked up over these types of assessments and might have difficulty. And then the intuition is to sort of avoid those things, or, you know, don't have them in those situations as much. But actually, the more frequent little quizzes you can put in, the less anxiety they will have, because they get really good at it. And each individual quiz is worth less, because, you know, it's all moving towards that 100%. So you can certainly have them do retrieval activities that they're doing retrieval, but they don't realize that they're taking a test, right? So it's sort of like pureeing broccoli and hiding it in brownies. So just to give your kids a little bit extra veggies at dessert. But you wouldn't want that to be the only way that they get broccoli, right? Because then when they grow up, they might be like, okay, well, I just eat brownies and brownies are healthy. Well, no, they're not normally, right? So giving them some of these tests and telling them this is a test and getting them used to it can be really helpful. But you can kind of also hide it into little activities, having them share, think, pair, share with one another, or, you know, explaining it to a partner or drawing a picture that represents an idea. Those are sometimes seen as fun and you don't realize that you're actually testing yourself when you're doing that.
I want to get back to that idea about sharing these strategies with students in just a couple seconds, but I want to talk about another strategy that I see that when you do spacing and you do retrieval, that means that a subject, you know, there's not the clear delineation we had when we were in school that this is unit one and that knowledge doesn't bleed over to unit two. And I think a lot of teachers are scared of confusing kids by having different units and different subject matters overlap or interweave. So can you talk to us about what the research says about that confusion teachers might try to avoid and why we maybe should encourage it?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a few things going on in there. And I think the main one really is the spacing, which is that inevitably, like you said, if you're going to be spacing, which means bringing previous information back instead of just, you know, stopping teaching that unit and then moving on to the next unit, then inevitably you're going to have some what we might call interleaving of topics where you teach a little bit about this one, then you come back to that one. Now, what you were referring to, this other strategy, is called interleaving. And the idea here is that switching back and forth between different things, and I'll go into what we mean by that, can actually be helpful to learning for a number of reasons. So this literature actually started out in sport. So if you think about like golf swings and you're practicing your golf swings, and I don't know anything about golf, so maybe that was a terrible example, but you're going to have different types of swings. Thank you for the visual there. But one way of practicing them would be to do the same one over and over again, right? And perfect it and get to where you can do the perfect swing, and then you could do the other type and then perfect that one. Or you could go back and forth and kind of do a few different ones in different orders. And the question is, okay, so which one is better? Which one is going to be make you a better golfer? And if you ask people who are practicing, they're going to tell you, if I keep doing the same one over and over again, I get better and better and better at it, that's a better way to practice. But in reality, if you have them practice and then you have them come back the next day or the next week, those who were going back and forth between different swings are actually going to be better at all those different swings, because in real life, you don't do the same golf swing 20 times in a row. You go and you have to pick the one that fits and then you do that one, right? So the final test there is the actual game of golf. And in order to perform well there, you have to be more flexible with your skill. And even just the one that you repeated 20 times in a row, you're going to be worse on it, because that, you know, you've only learned how to do it basically just starting from having done it 20 times already. Right? Whereas if you are having to figure out at each point, well, which golf swing should I use and how do I do this again, then you're going to be more effective at doing that in the future. Same thing applies to the most recent advances have been with mathematics and problem solving. So the idea there is that you could give a student practice on the same type of problem over and over again, which is actually very common in math textbooks and physics textbooks. You know, there'll be a concept introduced. I remember this from high school math. And then you will get to practice that particular type of problem. And if you figured out the way to solve one of them, they're mostly pretty similar. So you can just apply that same technique to the others. The interleaved version would be you've been introduced to a concept, and then maybe you've been introduced to another one a week ago. And then, you know, there are a few different ways of doing this, and then they're all mixed up. So as you're doing your homework, you're having to be like, wait, which formula do I use for this and how do I apply it? And during that practice, you may actually perform, or you will perform less well, because you'll make some errors of picking the wrong formula, or, you know, you will be slower because you'll have to think about it more. But if I then bring you back the next day, even, you will then still remember how to do it because you had to put in more effort there to figure out how to do it, versus the people who were practicing over and over again the same type of formula looked like they were getting up to mastery at 100% and then drop way down the next day. So those are cases where interleaving has been shown to be very helpful. Now, on a teaching level, in terms of what you were saying about teaching different topics and bringing them back, there hasn't really been as much research with that specific technique with respect to interleaving. We know it's helpful because it provides spacing. So it means that topics are being brought back. What we don't exactly know is how interleaving different content topics during teaching, like during one class, how that specifically affects learning, because the interleaving literature has mainly focused on problem solving or like physical skills. So that's a big open area, actually.
But I think based on the research now, a good rule of thumb for instructors would be anytime you think a student might need to be able to distinguish between two things or go back and forth between two things, or even just tell the difference and know when should I be applying one type of solution versus another together, that might be a place where interleaving would be appropriate. So if on a large exam, maybe an AP test or some larger comprehensive test, the students need to be able to tell the difference between events that happened during maybe World War I and World War II, maybe it might be a good idea to sort of combine some of those topics. Sure, you can teach World War I to start, but then when you're teaching World War II, it might be a good idea to continually keep going back to some of those concepts from World War I and putting them right next to one another. Another thing that Yana said that I really want to highlight is this concept of mastery. One of the things that I think is so cool about these studies of interleaving is that initially during learning, the students who are interleaving are performing worse. Now, they're not down all the way at 0%. It's not bad, but they're at about 80%. And I think if you were to stop and ask a lot of people, even, you know, researchers in other areas, if you just looked at that initial learning and saw 100% versus 80%, you would probably say, well, 100% is better. And if you stopped there, you would end up selecting the strategy that actually is worse in the long run. So that's why it's really important for us to focus on the research and test things in the long run, because if we were to just stop and say, well, which one of these do we think is better? Which one makes us feel like we're learning more? Which one is leading to the best performance right now? That's not going to be great in the long run. I think it's a Taylor and Rohrer paper. Those two authors, not sure about the exact order, from like 2010 or so.
Yeah, that's right. Taylor and Rohrer, 2010.
Okay. So Taylor and Rohrer, 2010, the performance for the blocking group is 100%. Performance for interleaving is about 80%. The very next day, the blocking group that was at 100% drops to about, I think it's 37%. The group that's interleaving goes from 80% to about 76%. And that's just after one day.
I think that is such an important point to drive home too, because so much, I think, of what happens in the classroom, you know, we rely on our expertise, our experience, things like this, and we like doing what feels good. We like doing what we think is helping in the moment. But a lot of times these strategies, like most all the ones we've talked about so far, like spacing, if you can't retrieve something the next day, you might feel worse about it. Like, I know I felt a lot better about cramming for exams. I felt like I knew more than if probably, like you just said, that other strategy would have worked so much better for me in the long run. And I think it's just a really important thing for our teachers to keep top of mind when we're in the classroom and trying to help out as much as we can, but really giving students the kind of strategies that they may not feel that great about leaving your classroom. And that's such a hard thing to do, because, you know, we want students to love our content area. We want students to leave our classroom loving math. And a lot of times, if, you know, we work on these strategies that they might not feel great in the moment, we're afraid that they won't love our content and won't, you know, want to practice that more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And one anecdote that I have, Cindy Niebel and I went last summer to Columbus. We were at community college in Columbus. I'm not sure the exact school, but there was a professor there, a math teacher, I think her name was Felicia Smith, and she talked about her math class, and she started just using spaced retrieval practice, and she eliminated exams from her class. And instead, just every single class at the end of class gave them a quiz. And those quizzes together were instead of exams. And so they were lower stakes, but they weren't completely low stakes, right? Because, you know, every day you're taking these quizzes and that is in lieu of any sort of big exam. And she said at first her students were really freaked out about it and they were really unsure and they kind of, like what you said, they didn't seem to like it. But after a little while, they got really used to it and they started to feel more confident. They realized that it was helping them in the long run and they really enjoyed it. And she said, you know, by the end of the semester, the students were like, bring it on, give me my quiz. What I think was so cool was that then a lot of those students, she said, took her next class the following semester. And she had overhauled the first course, but she hadn't overhauled all of her classes quite yet, right? She tried it in the first one. So the next class these students took, it was normal. They had exams. And the students were like, hey, where are our quizzes? Go give us that other format. And they were demanding this new format, which I thought was just a really, really interesting. And, you know, just because the students don't like something initially doesn't mean that they won't realize the benefit and gain confidence over time. But it does take time. It's not instant gratification like cramming is. And of course, a lot of students do then realize cramming helps me for this exam. But then on the final, you feel like you've forgotten it all. It doesn't have to be that way.
I'd love to hear a little bit too. That probably is where some of our maybe misplaced comfort lies with learning styles, because we feel good about, you know, learning in a visual way or an auditory way, and we tell ourselves that narrative for teachers and for students. And can you guys talk a little bit about the dangers of that?
I mean, I think the learning styles thing is very complex because it definitely stems from something that is undeniably true, which is that everybody has a preference for the way that they do things, including studying. So some people prefer to listen to a podcast versus read a book versus watch a video. I know, just as a personal anecdote, I really, really couldn't stand videos until I started making them, because I heard that that's what students enjoyed and we were trying to make something that students would choose to watch, right? But in the classroom, you know, students aren't necessarily just picking and choosing. Well, they shouldn't be picking and choosing. They should be attending to whatever the teacher is, you know, trying to present. And so the idea that learning styles are important comes from this notion that because we all have preferences, the idea is that matching different kinds of instruction to those preferences might increase learning. And you can kind of intuit that perhaps that might be true because, well, you know, if I just think I learn better a certain way, then, you know, shouldn't I be the best person to judge how I learn? And, you know, as a teacher trying to help me, shouldn't you, like, you know, make sure that you take into account that preference? And the answer from the literature about learning is that really there is no point in doing any of that, because this idea of matching instruction to preferences really does not actually boost learning. So a typical way to study that might be you take a group of students and you give them some kind of learning strategies questionnaire, which is a whole other problem that Megan can talk about, because there is no good learning styles questionnaire. There is no good learning styles questionnaire out there, because regardless, you know, you can answer one then answer another, you'll get two different learning style results. You could answer the same one twice at different moods, you would get different learning style results. So that's another problem. But anyway, let's imagine we had a good instrument, and then you find your group of people who are very, let's say, visual, and then you find another group who are very auditory or verbal or whatever you want to call it. Then what you would do in a good experiment is you would further subdivide each of those groups and then give half the group the format that they prefer, and then give the other group a format that they disprefer. So you have your visual learners and you give half of them pictures selected at random, right? And then you give half of them a podcast or whatever. And then you take your auditory learners, you also give half of them pictures, half of them a podcast. And so what we should see if learning styles matter is what's called a crossover interaction. And what that means is that we should find that the visual learners do best on pictures, and the auditory learners do best with the podcast, which sounds pretty obvious. However, there is not a single study out there that actually shows that effect. The only thing that even comes close to that is some studies that show that one of the two formats, often the one that includes pictures, is better for everybody. Or it's better for the visual learners, but then doesn't make a difference to the quote-unquote auditory learners, because those people are already at 100%. So that's, again, not showing that learning style is important. It's showing that one subgroup in that experiment needed additional information, where on top of just the auditory, having the pictures there as well gave them additional information. And so a lot of people, I think, get sort of trapped or tricked into thinking they're visual learners when they find a particular text difficult, and then they're given a more visual explanation and then it clicks and they're like, oh, I'm just a visual learner. I need things explained in pictures. And it's like, No. Have you ever been in a situation where instead of any verbal information, you were just given a really complicated diagram? Like, would you automatically understand it just because it's a picture? No, you wouldn't, because it lacks information. If I then gave you the verbal description of it, you would then understand it and I guess conclude you're a verbal learner, but that's less typical. Typically, we have the information, either there's a lecture or a book, and then the picture is like a supplementary material. So it's really an artifact of the way information is presented. And so just to loop back to your question about what's the danger of it, the danger is just spending time on something that's a waste of time, especially for teachers who in a lot of schools are required to demonstrate ways in which they're catering to different learning styles and differentiating their instruction so that students might be able to pick. A time-wasting situation where those teachers would be much better off using their time towards developing effective learning strategies, effective teaching strategies, rather than showing how they're differentiating based on something that doesn't actually help.
And I would say too that a lot of times it would be almost impossible, I think, unless you had a very small class or you were pulling small groups of students out or in a tutoring situation, to actually diagnose every single student's preference or style and then cater individually to those students. So what ends up happening is kind of what Yana mentioned, where, you know, there's visual information and verbal, auditory, all of those things sort of combined in a multimodal learning environment. And that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing. Problem is, if you think that you're doing something for a specific set of students, and then you're doing something else for a different set of students, it puts them in that mindset of, well, I'm learning from this one piece and not the rest of it. The professor or the teacher is doing this for me, whereas the other, you know, the professor is doing something for a different set of students and I don't need to pay attention to that. Well, that can create problems because you might not actually attend to all of the information and you might sort of further embrace this idea that I only learn in this one specific way. Well, certain types of topics are actually lend themselves to specific quote-unquote styles. So math is an area that tends to be less visual, at least when you get into more abstract type math, you know, calculus and that sort of thing. And students might think, well, I just can't do this because I only learn in this way. I can't learn in this other way. That's kind of a problem. This fixed mindset idea can be problematic. And then students might think, well, I'm just not good at math. I just can't do this thing. Or I'm not good at, you know, I can't become a surgeon because I'm not a kinesthetic learner, those types of things. And so, you know, embracing the multimodal learning and explaining we're doing all of these different things for everybody would be a better way of framing it, I think, personally, although I don't know how much research there is combining the idea of fixed versus sort of open mindset and learning styles. I don't know about research that combines those, but taking those two areas and sort of integrating them, that would be what I would assume is the case.
Yeah. I remember my first, when I was student teaching and you would look at the unit plan for US history and the teachers actually had to put in the unit plan how they had a certain number of like, oh, this will help the auditory learners. And so they had to actually in their unit plans plan out how they were going to address each learning style. And you're totally right that it does kind of promote a fixed mindset in students. So that's something hopefully teachers now are going to avoid. Love to hear what you all think about how you share and the importance of sharing all of your learning with students, not just the teachers.
Yeah, so we're in the process of trying to study an intervention. So we know that the six strategies are effective ways to process and learn information. So, especially, you know, if we are in a controlled setting or we make sure that the students are engaging in those learning strategies, we know that those will tend to promote longer-term learning. Of course, we've already talked about this notion that there's not one set way for every single person to do it ideally, but those types of processing are good. And especially if we can, you know, give ourselves some support and make sure that we're successful, it's going to lead to more long-term learning than doing, you know, other types of low-level things. What we don't know as much about or hardly anything about really is transferring that learning strategy to practice. So if I teach a student about an effective learning strategy. How do I then get them to transfer the use of that strategy in their own practice and make good decisions on their own? And it's very difficult to do because of these things that we've talked about where, you know, initially cramming works. Initially, rereading leads us to think that we're learning more than putting the notes away and practicing retrieval, which is hard. When I block practice, I can master it faster and I can get up to 100%. Whereas when I'm interleaving, I'm not doing as well. And so it's very difficult, we found, to sort of convince students to utilize these things. And I don't think we know the best way to try to teach them. We did learn in a pilot of our own that this, again, is not surprising in retrospect, but 2020, you know, the looking back is always 2020. Just giving them one of our, you know, a set of our materials. So we have posters on the website that just describe in one page with graphics how to utilize the strategy. Giving them that and telling them to do it does not lead to them actually doing it and does not lead to improved performance in the classroom. So we're playing around now with different ways that we can try to teach the students to use it, have them engage with the strategies, sort of practice using the strategies in the classroom, and then reflecting on the strategy and sort of what did they do that worked, what did they do that didn't work so well when they try it at home, what did they find, what are their struggles, what did they like about it, and then trying to keep revamping and keep going to a point where they can get to a point of using those strategies effectively. We're in the process of trying to do it, but we don't really have an answer yet. And sort of preliminary results seem to show that with some students, having them practice these strategies in the classroom helps improve their overall semester GPA. And for other students, it does not. And so we're trying to play with that and figure out the best way to help students utilize these strategies. I taught a first-year seminar myself at Rhode Island College, and our first-year seminars are 4 credits, which is all of our classes basically in the general education are 4 credits. So I had a lot of time to sit with the students and work on studying. And the topic of the seminar was the science of learning. And so it was the entire semester of talking about these strategies and learning how to utilize them and about the research process. And even with that, sometimes at the end of the semester, the students would say, yeah, but when I cram, I get a good grade. I'm like, ah, so it's very difficult. We're in the process of trying to figure it out, but we don't have an answer there quite yet. And some of the problem really is, I think, driven by what intuitively makes sense versus what works in the long term.
And before we close up shop, hey Siri, what time is it?
It's time to get out of our heads and into the classroom.
I need help! Somebody, please help me.
Help me!
Give me something I can use. Let's get out of our heads into the classroom.
That's right, it's Out of Our Heads into the Classroom, the part of the show where we give you tangible tips and actionable advice that you can put into use right away. And as you may have noticed, we backloaded this portion of the show. We're playing with the formatting a little bit, getting the interviews in right away, and then adding some great stuff at the end of the episode. So let us know what you think of the new format. And we're taking these tips, these Out of the Heads into the Classroom, right from the back of the Learning Scientist book. So if you want more, go to their website, order the book, use your school's P-card. Our first tip about how to get students to space out their studying. So we know it's really hard to teach students time management and to get them to realize that it's better in the long run if they space out their studying rather than cramming. And so the learning scientists have a cool way of having students do this. They recommend that you have students complete a time log for a week or maybe 2 weeks and record what they're doing every hour of the day, probably outside of school for a week. And then have them reflect upon their time and see where there might be time to fit in some study sessions. So I'm thinking of just using the built-in calendar app inside of the iPad and taking a screenshot of it and using markup, and they can color code different times of their day where they could find some time to schedule even just a little bit of blocked out time for interleaving and spacing to encourage them to do that. So talking to them about the importance of studying efficacy is super important, and we think that's just a really neat practice to do with students.
Another tip is around dual coding, which just means that you learn better when you're encoding knowledge in two different ways. So like reading and writing, speaking and drawing, listening and acting it out, etc. A fun way to do this is to have students attempt to draw visual representations of something they've read or talked about in class. One of the teachers in our district, actually, Adam Wellington, has his AP US History students doing sketchnoting on some of their complex concepts. And most of them have really embraced it as a study practice because it helps them remember things better. Follow him on Twitter to see some of those at A Wellington 83. And I've used sketchnoting a little bit to help myself remember the content from these episodes. It's so much. And you can see some of those at rainwaves.com.
Becky, you are going to be a famous sketchnoter. Some of your sketchnotes have been like retweeted hundreds of times. Like, you're famous.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. I know the John Hattie one was really popular. I loved it.
As we mentioned pre-interview, this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to research-based strategies for learning and memory. And as you heard the learning scientists say, there's always more work to be done when it comes to application of their principles into the class setting. We really recommend that you check out their blog. They have so many free resources like posters and slides to share with students, as well as links to their podcast. So check that out.
I'll throw in a couple more resources here, too. There's another guy, Blake Harvard. He's also called the Effortful Educator. He's an AP psychology teacher in Alabama, but he's got a blog that highlights research for educators in cognition and psychology. And he offers up some really readable and insightful articles on how this research translates to practice. And then last one, I promise, retrievalpractice.org has a ton of free materials. And they have an amazing book called Make It Stick that you'll devour in a weekend. And it'll really change the way you think about some of your practices.
There's a quote from Jana and Megan's book that we want to end with that we think summarizes a lot of what we talked about in this episode. So every time a memory is brought to mind, it is reconstructed and reinforced. When students take a quiz, they're not just checking their memory, they are enhancing it. And with that, we'll wish you a great generic time of day.